Hey, good morning or afternoon or evening or whatever time it is for you. It's Matthew and Jeff.
Hello.
And I feel like God is telling us to discuss what's going on in Japan right now and kind of drop our normal format. And if that's okay with you.
I think it's great. Let's depart.
Let's depart. And let's take up the question of what does Jesus think about nuclear power? Would that be okay if we framed it that way?
Sure.
Because I think Jesus has some definite thoughts on nuclear power.
What would Jesus nuke? Is that what you're asking? Or would Jesus nuke?
Or would he build a plant, I suppose? Well, unless you've been living under a rock somewhere, I think everyone in the world is tuned in to what's going on in Japan. And if ever there was a trifecta of disaster, Japan had that with an earthquake, and then a tsunami, and then a nuclear disaster. I don't know what more you could add to that. Mm. It's horrific. And I think that you would have to have a heart of stone not to have it just leap out for this country and the people affected. And at the moment that happens, I think also, at least for me, Jeff, I think, wow, everything that we have, all the security, and we kind of live taking that for granted, and something like this makes us thankful for what we have, and then kind of grows our heart, and we realize what people don't have.
It's heartbreaking, and again, just watching some of the clips of the water and just the relentless struggle that people with the earthquake first, and then the flood. It's just harrowing. And yeah, I think it's, like you say, it's broken everyone's heart who have seen into it.
And I'm going to, let's kind of probably put the cart in front of the horse. I kind of thought, well, what should people do about this on a very immediate level? And I was just with the Salvation Army in Florida. Nancy and I were down there at a conference. It was a green conference. And the Salvation Army was exploring not only how they can be green, but how they can, through being green, through being good stewards of their resources, how they can further their mission. And that's really what we're all about, whether it's the Salvation Army or the Southern Baptists or the Lutherans or whatever. That's what we're about, is how do we do God's work and have more resources to do that. And to that end, I would have to say that one of the websites that I opened, I think it was either the New York Times or Yahoo, said, you know, how can you give if you are moved to do that? And they had about 6-7 agencies, and the Salvation Army was one of those. They'd been in Japan as an active organization since, I believe, 1895.
Oh, wow.
And so that's the one that I knew the best, because I had just been with the people and knew their heart. It's also ironic to me that the last earthquake that's really, you know, shook our sense of stability was in Haiti. Mm. And the Salvation Army is really one of the biggest churches and organizations in Haiti. So either direction the money goes with them, it's going to go to help people that are hurting. Right. So if you feel like giving, that would be one. If you have a suggestion.
No, that's a great example. And you mentioned that this weekend, as we saw it unfolding, that my mind turned to Haiti, and just that there's continuing struggle there, and the resources that, infrastructure that's destroyed is just continuing to not be rebuilt, and there's so much poverty there too, and so you kind of, it's overwhelming in some respects. But Salvation Army is fantastic, do wonderful work.
They are great, and if that army had about 3 million more members, I think that the earth would be perfect or whatever. And so anyways, they we'll continue with, you know, what would Jesus say about nuclear plants. And Nancy and I were in Nashville yesterday with a group of Christian music leaders, both the performers and producers and all the people that are involved in the industry. And we were talking about greening up the Christian music industry, that sort of thing. And I felt like I had to talk about what's going on as far as the nuclear plants. in Japan, and everybody has opinions on things. But very few people have expertise, and I'm not an expert in things nuclear, but I did give the qualifications that I have, which are not many, but I was an English and physics major. I have 21 hours of physics in undergraduate classes. I have, from the other side, Nancy and I were evacuated from the Three Mile Island area. Wow. When that happened in 79, they tracked us down and paid us to be evacuated. So we've actually made money off a nuclear disaster. Yeah. I think we got about $400 or something out of that. And I also was in an emergency department on the coast of Maine, where we were the main decontamination hospital for the Maine Yankee plant, and was there both when the plant was running and then also during the decommissioning process, and worked with the EMS systems and that sort of thing. So I have a little bit of knowledge with that. And then kind of an oddball thing, my son's father-in-law, who when he's in town, lives here in Lexington, is kind of an expert on this. He's a nuclear engineer. He's not in town, though, most of the time, because most of the time for the last 7 years, he's been running for the EU and Bechtel and consortium, the cleanup effort at Chernobyl. So we've had a couple of conversations about this. Wow. And he's a very thoughtful man, very brilliant. And so those are the qualifications that I have, such as they are. Not, you know, not much, but a little bit.
Well, you have me beat three or four times over, so go ahead.
Well, you've had an X-ray, right?
I've had X-rays.
There you go. So you've got a little nuclear knowledge. And so, you know, this is what I thought is, and I get asked this question, what do you think about nuclear power? There's certainly been a lot of pressure to expand the U.S.'s nuclear power-making capabilities. And that's seen as a good thing for a number of reasons. One is that nuclear power doesn't really contribute significantly to carbon dioxide. And that's viewed by many people as being a very positive thing. The nuclear advantage is just tremendous. To just kind of put it just in a little layman's kind of terms that you might understand. If I were to take a nuke plant and I were to take a coal-fired plant and make them equivalent number of megawatts, and kind of do the standard one in the United States generating capability, the coal plant would need about 240 train cars full of coal per day to operate. So you can think about 240 cars going by if you just happen to be stuck, you know, waiting.
Stuck at a crossing.
Stuck at a crossing, waiting for those to go by, you know, just how much coal that is. And an equivalent nuclear plant would take about one small U-Haul truck every 18 months. And so there's a real...
Of uranium?
Of uranium, okay. Yeah. Of nuclear fuel. And so the nuclear advantage is tremendous over typical chemical reactions. The nuclear reaction is just packed with energy, and we are a world that needs lots of energy, and so nuclear has been very attractive. Nuclear has some problems, though, and one of those is it's very expensive to build the plants. The generating part of the plant, the part that actually generates electricity, is virtually the same as a coal plant. You just take steam and you run turbines with it. And so that part of the plant is the same. But the part where you have the nuclear fuel and the nuclear reaction going on is much more expensive to build and very expensive to unbuild, to decommission them when they reach that point. And so expense has always been a problem with nuclear. Another problem with nuclear is we don't have a standard design. You know, we kind of have some standard designs for planes that we go up in. Mm. You know, you've got the Airbus 330 or whatever, 777 or 67 or whatever. And we have some standard designs, but there aren't really standard designs for nuclear plants. They're kind of, in the United States, have been built very site-specific. And so that adds to cost and complexity and that sort of thing. Another problem is getting the fuel there and doing something with the fuel once it's no longer as potent, once it's kind of spent, as they say. And that poses some problems both in risk of radiation but also in diversion, diverting these materials to terrorists or to make weapons, etc. Because, you know, once coal ash, you can't do much with it. You can't make a weapon
out of coal ash. It's not a weapon of mass destruction.
No, it's not.
So after it's been spent in terms of its energy use, it can still be used for a weapon?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And so that's always been a problem. That's a problem in former Soviet areas and knowing where all that's gone. And then simply storing those spent fuels has always been a problem where you put them. Everybody thinks nuclear is great as long as it's not upwind from them.
That's right. Not in my backyard. Yeah. So and why can't they just shoot it off into space, to ask a really question that my 7-year-old might ask?
That's a good question, and it's simply a matter of weight. The well, there's probably two factors. One is weight. Uranium and plutonium and the heavier, you get up over a nuclear number like 230 or whatever, and things get very heavy. Mm. If you think about how heavy lead is, nuclear fuel is even heavier. Mm. And so to eject a significant amount of that in space would be a payload that would just be astronomical in price to get rid of.
That was a good pun, astronomical.
There you go.
Shoot it into space.
And the second thing is rockets have a way of coming down. Not where you put them, and that's happened even with the shuttles that we see. That's a system that has some risk with it, and so those are the two reasons we don't shoot it off into space.
Okay, and one more question about what you said with decommissioning: is there the life of one of these nuclear power plants? Is it last 50 years and they've got to decommission? Why would you decommission? Is it
Well, they have very hot water running through them. They have very high pressures. They are often located near bodies of water. They always are. They're located near rivers or oceans, and so there's corrosive forces at work there. And it's just like no matter how well you take care of your car, 30 years later, it's not in the same place as when you bought it. So things wear out, and I don't know exactly what the lifespan of a nuclear plant is. I think it's around 30, 35 years, and then they have to be decommissioned.
Wow. That's an expensive thing to build, and for it to only last 30 years, calculate that.
Yeah, although they supply lots of power,
right?
Lots and lots of power, and they do that without polluting the air, like a coal plant, and so they've got some positives. Here's the problem, though. We now have in one site in Japan 4 reactors that are, I think, going to eventually all be in a meltdown or near meltdown state. We've got 2 that have, quote, melted down.
Reactors at one site?
The reactors at one site. Okay. You count reactors by a containment core around it. And many sites have a couple of reactors. I think Three Mile Island had 3.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong there, but it had more than one reactor, and the others continued to run after the meltdown reactor at Three Mile Island was put offline, and so they're often built together, and in Japan there are 4 at this site that are 2 of them at least, as far as I know, and the news stories say have at least partially melted down. I think they'll probably lose all 4. And I think they'll end up having to do something like Chernobyl, where they build a containment dome over the disaster site. And here it'll be over 4 reactors. By the way, that containment dome over Chernobyl will need to be rebuilt in 50 to 100 years. And it's been at the cost of many billions to build it. And so this will be an ongoing cost for multiple generations. Containment dome, just like a reactor, cannot last forever. And
so in that containment dome, nothing is actually going on in terms of a reaction apart from the natural radiation leaking.
The decay. And you bring a certain number of these radioactive rods together and they start a reaction. What happens is in order to quell or damp down the reaction, they put like lead bars down between them. The lead absorbs that. And then when they scramble a reactor, that's what happens. You either pull up the rods or you put down lead bars kind of between them. And so none of that will be controlled. It's all melted down,
right,
as far as I know. And please forgive me for what I don't know, you experts out there. But here's just roughly the numbers as I see them. You have about 440 nuclear plants or nuclear reactors around the world. And you've got four that just went offline permanently. I would call a disaster at those. You have Chernobyl and you have Three Mile Island. And there are other plants, by the way, that have been taken off without kind of the disasters going, but that have been taken offline early because of problems at them. So you have six that we can say are disasters out of 440. Now, you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out that's about 1.5% of the world's nuclear reactors have melted down, have failed. And I think the question is that a tolerable number? If you were having a nuclear plant built in your town and you were told, well, there's about a 1 in 50 to 1 in 100 chance that this will melt down.
Wow.
Would you go for it? And that's what we're talking
about. Not in my backyard.
Yeah, exactly. That is really the reality here. No matter what somebody puts a spin on it about how safe it will be, etc., that's what experience shows us now. That's our experience with nuclear plants, is that about 1% to 1.5% to maybe 2% are going to have some kind of significant problem. 1% at least are going to melt down and release radiation. And to me, that would make me vote no if they were going to put one here in Lexington.
Right.
What about you?
Well, yeah, I read an article probably about a year ago from Bill McKibben about this as an energy option, and he's kind of journaled about his own shift from never to this might be the only option we have if we're going to sustain the kind of energy use. So there's that pragmatic thing, and then it comes back to, like you say, calculating the risk. But I, you know, it's frightening. I mean, I grew up kind of just on the edge of a lot of the fear about nuclear disaster. And so I have a little faint memory of how terrible that is. And I think there's a movie called The Day After I remember watching as maybe an early teenager and being horrified at the terror around that. But it's a really tough situation because we do need and use energy a lot and increasingly. And apparently Japan was number one in the world in terms of per capita use, and France is like second. I don't know much about.
Well, and I don't know where we rank, but we have about 20% of our electrical energy comes from nuclear. roughly 70% comes from coal, 60 to 70%. And then virtually all the remainder comes from water, from dams, hydropower, with about 1+% being wind and solar. By the way, we've really moved backwards in the last 50 years in the amount of energy that we get from alternative or clean sources, because it used to be every farm in the United States pulled their water up out of the ground, not using electricity, but wind. So
right.
They had windmills.
Yeah.
So we've really moved in the opposite direction here. Huh. We're not moving ahead on this. And the question is, well, what would Jesus do about this? I tend to think Jesus was like the smartest guy who ever lived. You could never get from the movies about Jesus. You know, he always kind of stands there with that goofy terry cloth robe on, you know, and kind of just saying a couple words now and then.
And he's very nice to kids.
He's very nice to kids, and he's really hard on you if you happen to be a money changer in the temple. But I think that the portrayals in movies, and even sometimes the way we read the Bible, makes Jesus look like a very stupid, monodimensional character. Right. Instead of thinking, as it says at the end of the book of John, you know, if everything Jesus said was written down, it'd fill all the books in the world. What the, that's shorthand for this guy was really smart. Mm-hmm. You went fishing with him, everybody else got skunked. He got the trophy, you know, sailfish. You know, you went and you did a clam bake. He outdid everybody. If you wanted to parse words, he could, you know, do whatever. You know, you wanted to go bronco busting, he could make the bronco just, you know, an unridden colt just hold still. You know, it was just Jesus outdid everybody on everything. And so I think if Jesus were alive today, and he is in you and me, he would want us to kind of outsmart this, to outthink it to some extent, and at least think logically about it. To me, I think that the area that we can do right away is efficiency. To cut down on the amount of power that we need, so at least we can develop better the technologies to make nuclear safer or coal cleaner. I actually think that might be an oxymoron, but right. But I don't know enough to really pass judgment on that completely. To really cut down and to really push towards efficiency, which I believe that we have just barely begun to do. We have in our family gifts that are called Just Because gifts. And you give the gift to somebody just because. It's not their birthday. It's not an anniversary. Just because you love them. That's and you nice. Were thinking about it. So we're in a new house, and we have a couple of light fixtures in our bedroom that are incandescents. They're recessed lights, and so they're 60, 75 watts apiece. And I've changed lots of other bulbs in the house. I hadn't gotten to those. And I went to the store, and I got LED dimmable warm tone bulbs, and I thought, when Nancy sees
that
this,
really,
I'm a lucky guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, just because,
yeah. But just, you know, to go from 75 watts to 10, and then to put it on a dimmer, and bring the 10 down to 5, maybe, you know, that's 1/10 the energy used just in changing a bulb. And there are many, many things. The car that I drive gets 50%. More miles to the gallon than the one that I had, the old type before. It's a hybrid. I think we're only beginning to scratch the surface with efficiency. And the problem is that efficiency is not sexy.
There's, right.
You know, even though, as I just pointed out with that bulb, it can be really sexy, you know.
Right.
I'll let you know what Nancy's response was.
Okay,
you know,
yeah.
Once the bulb's in place. But you know, it's just like I was in emergency medicine. They have TV shows on it. We are fascinated by disaster and emergency and pulling out the ambulances and the helicopters and all that sort of thing. And there's never, ever, ever will be a show on called prevention.
That's right.
And yet to me, that's what Jesus is all about. You know, that he really wants to keep us away from some of these problems. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, yeah.
Jesus, the prevention guy.
Yeah, and I guess it's starting to reclaim that kind of wisdom, the kind of wisdom that gets to the heart of being a conservationist or conservative. You conserve things. It's reclaiming that, valorizing it. I'm not sure we'll ever be able to make it sexy, but how do we inhabit the kind of lives that make that kind of living really worth celebrating and really compelling? And I think there are, you know, there are still ways to do that. We had a friend just recently say, "Well, I'm not poor like you. I have a dryer." And you know, if we can turn that around and say, "Well, not having a dryer, actually, you know, we don't miss it. Every now and then we miss it. But for the most part, it actually creates a little rhythm in our house about hanging out laundry. And we can prayerfully do that, as Matthew's written in his book." And so there's a sense that we have to take what we have and turn it back around and make it compelling. I to be honest, I don't know how you do that with all the clutter and the noise of our culture. I don't think we're going to win in that realm. I don't think we're going to win this one through social media.
You don't think so? Because I have long wanted to make ads for these things, because so much of our society is driven by ads. And, you know, just to have a beautiful babe hanging up clothes on the line.
There you go.
You know, and because they try to make everything seem glamorous and sexy, and why not make hanging up the laundry, you know, that way, or have, you know, some guy, you know, all bulked up, you know, flipping out the shirts and hanging them up. I don't know, but
it might work. You can do it. Right. I think that would be great.
Yeah, no, we want more people to do this, okay. Not less. But so I think that what I walk away from this is a kind of a caution. And I think, you know, test all prophecies. You know, if somebody's telling you, well, this can't go wrong. Experience in medicine has told me that there are many, many people who will trot in with glossy ads telling you how, you know, miracle, you know, drug X is going to cure everything and has no side effects. And by the way, here's some samples and a pizza. And you just find out that that's not true. And I've thought about this quite a bit. At least in medicine, we have the experience of killing people. You know, if you take people at their word and you dish out brand X and without thinking about it, you're going to kill somebody. And that's a very humbling thing. Or you're going to make somebody sick. Or and you begin to learn that first do no harm. In a lot of things in engineering, that's not true. You know, there's 6 nuclear plants that have gone down. We don't know the names of the people who did that. They don't get sued as individuals or anything. I'm sure they feel terrible, but there's no accountability in some of these things. And so, you know, to me, some of the wisdom that comes from practicing medicine ought to be applied when we practice some of these other technologies, that we understand that there are limitations, that we are responsible, and we ought to go slowly. First, do no harm. And so I walk away with, today we can start being more efficient in our businesses, in our churches, in our homes. We can make a goal of cutting back 10%. You know, 10% less energy used in your house doesn't sound like much, but 4 less nuclear plants in the world is. If they happen to be these 4 that didn't have to get built, that would have been a good thing. And so efficiency. And then I think for me, the other walk away thing is if you're moved, you know, your heart is, you know, contact the Salvation Army and give some money or a similar Red Cross or whatever, and go ahead and give some.
Yeah, it's staggering, the human costs and tragedies foremost for me, but this is a helpful conversation because it does draw us into these deeper questions of energy, and again, I would really recommend the Kilowatt Hours movie. There's a wonderful kind of summary. It's worth watching the whole thing, but there's a wonderful summary at the end that it addresses this issue of, well, what are we going to do if the pie is this big and we cut it up in these ways, you know, coal and so on and so forth. The one piece that we're not looking at is our use and how do we reduce that. And in the effectively, we're contributing to the energy that's available.
And we'll try to put a link on that to our website. That's a friend, Jeff Berry, that made that movie, which is very inspiring to me when I saw it. And it's Kilowatt Hours, as in H-O-U-R-S.
Oh. No, it's right. O-U-R-S.
Oh, yeah. R's.
That's right. Kilowatt Hours.
It's a play on that.
That is.
Don't listen to me. We'll put
the
link on.
My accent makes it more difficult.
There you go. Kilowatt Hours, Jeff Berry, great guy, great movie. Salvation Army, they're the ones out in the cold in front of the grocery stores in the wintertime. They're the ones with the bands. You know, and last thing, I was just writing an article on how to choose a church and had these things. And I finally came to this bottom line. Maybe you should choose a church by who you would want coming to get you if you were in jail. If your town had just been knocked over by a tsunami, if you had a trouble with drugs or alcohol, or you were just ill, maybe that's the way you ought to choose a church. Who would you want coming to get you? And when I think about that, boy, the Salvation Army would be right up there on the top of my to-choose list. So God bless, and we'll see you soon.